this morning with the sun down shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Hey, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
You talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Well, OPEC, Sykes and Jax, I'm Tim Howe. Ricky on the board, SP futures up 5, the NASDAQ futures up 66 after we settled at a record yesterday. We have valuations kind of going to the moon here. We've got the balance sheet from the Fed grew again last week, even though we seem to have a guy who wants that to go down. You know, it's not what people say, kind of it's what they do sometimes. But we have Professor Kevin.
All right, good morning.
Hey, very interesting, I think, well, in terms of if you like stocks or anything or whatever, Kevin, or what, certainly as a professor, when you're talking about how much you pay for this, how much you pay for that, I think the discussion this week regarding people's view of the world when you invest in something, it's obviously very key. I mean, what do you think is going to happen when you're paying X for Y? And I was on with Joel yesterday on his podcast, and there are people that call in there, you know, talk about specific stocks, but the incredible, talk about a question that somebody came up with. He must have a listenership as smart as ours. Because, you know, I don't like really answering questions on specific stocks because I don't know the person I'm talking to, whether he has money, doesn't, you know, that kind of thing. But by and large, you can do something. And we started making the connection between the Lakers sale and the valuation and what their view of the world must be. You know, of course, there's some psychic income that goes with it and all those other kinds of things. But if you throw that out, you know, basically what do the Lakers, the people who buy the team, think the world's going to look like in 5 or 10 years? By the money they paid. What does it mean for inflation? What does it mean for ticket prices? What does it mean for, you know, is everybody in China going to be paying $1 a game to watch it on their tablet? Maybe. Could very well be. But one of the listeners called in and said, what about, Manchester United? Is that public, Kevin? I think it might be. Is it? Or some parts of it is?
Anyways, no.
But anyway, the value of Manchester United, and Joel was digging these numbers up, so I'm assuming he did it right. The revenue was roughly the same as the Lakers, and yet the value was more in the $4 to $4.25 billion range than the 12. So roughly a third. Now, I'll ask you, what does that mean? It seems like soccer is very much growing. I mean, as much as basketball, I can't tell the difference. The streaming services over there must be sort of the same as here. I don't know that, but why would you think that is it just the Brits' view of what the world's going to look like 10 years from now is not quite as rosy, or do people here get more psychic income? You know, and I'll try and tie this back into the stock market. And if you buy a stock that has, you know, I'll take an example I gave on the air yesterday with Joel. Take a Palantir. They're trading, they're trading like 48 times revenue or something. Now, they could very well double revenue every year for the next 10, and it could be a screaming buy here. But you better have that view if you're going to pay that kind of a premium. If you think they're a slow growth company, guess what? You're paying too much. And it's kind of fascinating when you think about it, though, Kevin. And anywhere you want to comment, just pile in here. I mean, Do you think the people in UK even realize they have a third less view of the two-thirds less view of the future than the Laker owners, or they never the Laker owners get more psychic income, or what do you suppose all these differences are?
Well, I can tell you from a financial standpoint. I think Lou probably had it right yesterday when he said, you know, it's like saying I must have that Van Gogh painting. Some people are willing to just say I must have it, and you know, and so they'll pay whatever it takes.
Well, okay, but when you do that, I suppose if you inherited the money, and I'm not going to say it's not as dear to you as if you know laid railroad track for it, but maybe it is, maybe it isn't. You know, for a Van Gogh is somewhat, to the extent that you can show it to people, it's kind of a consumption good as well as an investment good. It's kind of a combo, right? And so are basketball teams and football teams, and you know how much that interplays. Well, you know, that's another huge question, right? But you know, when it comes down to it, if you and I really want the Lakers, and we're saying, well, we don't care what we pay. Well, if we're borrowing the money and have to pay interest on it, we better sober up real quick, right? Because right now, I mean, I've got even at 6%. You know, the $12 billion is what? $720 million a year? And the earnings are 150? Well, we better get a lot of psychic income because somebody's got to make up that $600 billion difference, right? So, I mean, to a certain extent, if everybody has the money and it's chump change, you know, I'm sort of with you, but it would be hard to convince... Let's put it this way. It'd be hard to convince minority partners to go along with that game unless they all want to join the right country clubs too. You know what I'm saying? And at some point, you know, I guess if you didn't even know you had just an admirer and one day somebody, you know, dropped you a check of, you know, $15 billion, I'm not even sure what a check of $15 billion would look like. I guess you would be more likely to not have to actually... you know, go down the financing road, but the numbers still count, though, don't they? I mean, you could put the $12 billion in the bank and never have to do anything again for you and God knows how many generations after you.
Yeah, so maybe it's a crappy investment, but if it generates positive cash flow, you know, a positive EBITDA, doesn't have to be big, just has to cover the cash flow in it, then... And you want to be the BSD who can, I can always take my friends to my owner's suite and so on. Then, you know, there's some people that just have money to burn and they're gonna go ahead and do it that way. As an investment, yeah, there's, you know, probably 1,000 better investments in terms of ROI on it. But as long as you're recovering the cash on a operating basis and you have the money to throw around, who am I to criticize that mindset? I think it's nutty myself, but okay.
Well, yeah,
but you know, knock yourself out. You want to buy that? You want to buy the Lakers for that much? Knock yourself out.
Well, I always come at this, and I'm kind of, I think you are too. We're just jousting. It's one thing to just say, and by the way, 10 people have said to me the same thing. Hey, if you got the dough, what's the difference? Well, you know. Sometimes the reason why people have dope is because they think there is a difference. I mean, the reason why Jerry Jones got a gazillion dollars is because he thinks the next dollar is important to him as the first dollar. Okay, not many people think that way, but some guys do it, and a lot of rich people do. I mean, I think. I've dealt with a lot of them. But there's a difference between, you know, just, you know, tossing it off either, you know, I won't say half-assed like we're doing, or over a beer and say, well, you know, that's what... I look at it as, what if you and I were making this presentation to the minority shareholders? How exactly are we going to make it sound like it's a good deal? Because now all of a sudden we really all need the numbers, we need all the other stuff. It'd be pretty hard for us to say, God, it's a horse bleep deal, but Carl's our leader and he's going to get a gazillion dollars of psychic income and sit in every skybox in the country for the next 10 years, so it's worth it for you, you know what I'm saying? It might be worth it for him, but is it worth it for you? When you actually have to put the numbers down and show them to somebody, I mean, they sort of can't be embarrassing, you would think.
Well, but, yeah.
So, so Well, I mean, but when you turn that into stocks, and I don't think people get any psychic income out of stock. So when you look at essentially a growth stock, and it's trading for higher valuations than say a, you know, whatever, a mature company, you have to sort of be on board with the growth trajectory, because you are paying up. And if you think, oh, these guys think they're going to double every year, I think they're going to only go up 25%. Well, boy, you're kind of in the wrong place, right?
So an investor and a collector are going to have a different mindset. But I think that's kind of self-evident here. And, okay.
Well, but the reason why I kind of brought it up is we are on record highs on the market. And a lot of stocks are priced as if they're going to just grow like a weed from here. Okay, that could very well happen, or it sort of may not. If you listen to the different people on the show, Kim, which I know you do, there's sort of like two shots here. I mean, one is the market's been going up forever. AI is going to help out to a huge extent or some extent or whatever. You're not going to have any impediments by the government. They're going to make money. We're going to be easy money for another, you know, whatever, how many years, however many it takes, surely, before this election, the next election, and the next election after that. I mean, nobody's going to...
Probably me, surely.
Well, okay. but I mean, that's sort of like highway number one. And by the way, that highway's been the right highway for a long time. The other highway is, oops, you know, our interest rates are creeping up, not down. So whatever that is, it started this whole mess. The interest rates going down starting in 1981. That ship seems to have sailed. They're going the other way. Now, it clearly hasn't. They haven't gone up enough to affect people's interest in the stock market. And people still think their stocks are going to double every year, so they're not going to worry whether the treasury rate is 1% or 5%. Maybe if it was 8 or 10, they might, we're not there yet, maybe never. The other is, well, okay, now we've got $400 billion, which I'm going to go over with Carl, deficit last month, another new record. And we have, you know, this ballooning deficit that either is going to cause, you know, more borrowing, which generally would mean interest rates go up, or it's going to mean more taxation, which, you know, everybody wants to clench their behind when they hear that. But the simple fact is, you can't be running $200 billion last month with 400 deficits every month and with no tomorrow, especially if you're borrowing from other people, then you got to be careful that the other people are healthy. So there's kind of two parallel roads here, Kevin, and I wish I knew which one we're going to stay on and for how long, or if they're ever going to collide, and if they do, how bad. I mean, that's really the crux of a lot of the stuff we talk about. I think I described it pretty well. I mean, there are two different points of view here. I mean, even me thinking that we're way over our skis on financing and borrowing and all that kind of stuff, I don't think it's going to end today. I mean, I'm not going to go out and buy puts this morning and be thinking, oh, man, the world's going to end, and it's going to be like noon today. I don't think that way. Yet I also know that you can't keep doing this like forever. Now, what's the difference between not today and not forever? What's the day or the month or ever? I mean, you know, would you have any? And we talked about education way too high. All of a sudden, people can't. Your investment in education, which both of us think is one of those spectacular things you can do, that has a price on it too. I mean, I'd love to know something about supply chain management. And if I had the time and I was close to one of your classes, a night class, I might go do it, because instead of asking you about it all the time, maybe I'd actually learn something, be able to tell somebody else.
Hey, wait a minute. Rephrase that.
Well, I mean, I'd say I'd actually learn something about what it is instead of just saying, hey, Kevin.
Instead of asking me, you'd actually learn something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, learn something that I wouldn't have to ask you, or that you sort of embedded in my head. Now, if that's, you know, $500, I'm saying, well, I'll do that. If it's $7,000, like a course the University of Chicago is now, or it might even be more than that, I'm not sure, so sure I'd do it. I mean, price is part of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is with how do we get, Kevin, when we talk about education, and it's kind of the, well, I'm not going to go into it, but it's sort of like, in the marketing term, it's the wheel of retailing. When somebody gets way too high and somebody can provide the same product for less, that's what they usually do. That's the beauty of what we're supposed to be, a competitive economy here. But How do you value? And you know, I'll be straight with you. If somebody goes to Ivy Tech and goes to, you know, 2 years of say accounting or finance or something or engineering, even trying to get be the third or fourth year of Purdue and or Illinois or someplace, Notre Dame. Somehow or another, even if your guys are the best professors around, there's this stigma, or I won't say it, it's probably the wrong word, more the other way. In other words, you could be the biggest, well, you can't be probably the biggest dummy, but if you're the biggest, you know, if you're the biggest, actually I know a guy who hired a guy from there and they had to fire him. If you go to Harvard Law School versus, say, John Marshall, you could actually be sitting at John Marshall with 10 of the best professors around and know just as much as the guy from Harvard, but the world view of you is what, 1/100th of the Harvard guy?
Well, and that's for two reasons. One is that for that law school, there would have been some degree of undergraduate performance that suggests that you were a really, really good student, and that's how you got into Harvard. But really, more than anything else, what you're getting out of Harvard, more so than the education, you might be exposed to some really, really good professors. I have no doubt about that. But you're getting their connections. You're getting the network, just like Notre Dame. You're getting the network if you go to Notre Dame. And that's what you get for your $80,000 or whatever it is a year to go there.
Well, no, but as an employer, as an employer, if I want to hire a young attorney, what do I care whether you have a network or not? I'm looking for a young attorney who can do something for me.
Well, yeah, you are, but if you have a network, that means there's clients you can bring in.
Well, I mean, I guess is my usual question, Kevin. I know I'm boring with this. Is I get it. The question is, how much?
Always is.
Yeah, the question is how much, and there's some selection process. But how do I know the guy who is sitting in a class at Ivy Tech didn't ace high school, didn't do very well, do real well on his boards, and oh, by the way, he's got a sick parent or something and just can't go to Harvard or can't go to Illinois Engineering, and he's sitting at Ivy Tech. How do I know that? I can't just assume that. That he's a lower class citizen.
Story, and it's hard to get to tell your story nowadays. So the way things are screened. So I get what you're saying. But in the areas where I can speak, business, IT, and so on, you know, and Russell would has always supported this. He says some of his best students got their first 2 years of education at Ivy Tech. And then he got them at IU. So, I don't think we take a back seat to anybody. I know what kind of material I teach, and it's a lot of the stuff that I'm teaching in intro level courses is stuff that I had in grad school.
Well, I'm not making the point very well here, but in the wheel of retailing, it means that if you have a wine store. And it's the nicest damn wine store on earth, like maybe a Binny's or something. The shelves are the best. The coolers are the best. You know, the place is gorgeous. There's wine tasting. There's all this kind of crap. And you charge $25 for this bottle of wine, and I get on a block to the wine discount center, and it's piled up in cases on the floor, and it's $16. Nobody is going to tell me that I'm an ass or a cheapskate for going to or think less of my wine because I went to the wine discount center than if I went to Binny's. Yet, if we think Notre Dame is way too expensive, or University of Chicago, and hire just as good of professors, and get into a burned-out high school in Chicago and fix it up, and pop somebody out with an MBA, nobody's going to believe it's equivalent. And the person is going to be looked down at because of it, unlike the bottle of wine. Which is, and you're right, they're going to get more.
I quibble with nobody's going to look down on it. I agree with a lot of people are going to won't see it as equivalent.
That's what I meant. That's what I meant. They won't see it as near as equivalent, and it's probably pretty close. So there's when we quibble about the cost of higher education and any other stuff, be it wine, be it, you know, cheesecake, whatever it is, the response would be somebody else does it cheaper and just as good, and people, and they can tell people that, and they go to the other place. There's no, they don't have to, well, you got to go to the, can't make sure there's no rats in the place, but you don't have to get an accreditation. You don't have to do all the stuff in the meantime to where the person paying, you know, charging a lot of money now is somewhat protected, A, by reputation, B, by maybe the ability to get, you know, certified, but all the other kind of stuff, right? I mean, it's, so there's a stickiness to it that is, I won't say it's monopolistic, but it's pretty damn close, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that.
Well, so are you part of the team, the group that bought the Lakers? Does that mean, what does that put?
I would buy a team I like.
Oh, there you go. Well, what's his name? LeBron's not playing there this year, right? Where's he playing?
Philadelphia.
So they got him, and they got Embiid, who's good for a third of the season, as great as he is. And you got LeBron at age, what is he, 60 yet? Or what's, not, he's not 60, but what do you think?
I don't know if he qualifies for the senior discount at the grocery store or not.
Well, he's had one hell of a career. How much do you think he has left to really help people?
Well, I think that's part of why he went to Philadelphia. He doesn't want to be the guy. He wants, you know, he wants to get the ball when he wants to get the ball, but he's not. If they're counting on him to win every game for him, like if he had gone to Cleveland, they might. Although Cleveland's got some good ball players too.
Cleveland was better than Philly last year, weren't they?
Might have been, at least in the standings.
Well, what do you think of the races?
But they also picked up the guard from the Celtics. That was so good last year. So Philadelphia's got dudes.
Well, if that one kid ever had a really good year, they're as good as anybody, but I don't know. I think he's that Embiid guy. He's as good as I've seen in a long time, but unfortunately, the knee just won't heal for him, will it?
Doesn't appear to be. So,
what do you think of the baseball races this year? Boy, they're wild, huh? I mean, they're going to have the wild cards are going to be all over the place. I mean, especially in the American League, the division race where the Sox is now, Detroit's right in the middle of it. Cleveland, they're now in last place, aren't they?
Well, they're fading. Cleveland is fading. Yep.
Who do you like this year? I mean,
2 weeks ago they were making a run at the White Sox.
Yeah. I mean, is it just kind of what do you think? The odd scheduling now that when you play a team. Sometimes you only play them twice, but you play them like a week apart. You notice that? Like some of the teams outside of your division, like the Cubs will play like Seattle. I don't know, but I remember somebody, they played Seattle like on a, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and the next week they were in Seattle. I mean, to a certain extent, if one team has got some injuries there a couple weeks and the other guys are doing really well, that really hurts you, doesn't it? But
well, it's always when do you play them? Who you play?
Where do you see it now with these this baseball? Other than it looking like it's going to be a real interesting month of September. You've got Tampa Bay, which is seemingly ahead of everybody, right? And the Dodgers, but San Diego's making some noise.
Dodgers have been slumping too, and they pissed away a game last night that they had under their control. Against the Brewers. Damn it!
Yeah. Well, you think, you know, the Cubs might catch the Brewers, but
they could, but they lost a game to them yesterday.
No, they got clobbered by the Nationals, but they won 2-3. But you know, the Nationals are going to get. I still can't get over how young that team is. Those guys. What do you make of? We're piling into it. We'll talk to Carl about this probably more. But how far do you think this deficit financing can go, Kevin? I mean, I keep saying it can't go much further, and then every month it goes further. So I'm the wrong person to ask. I mean, where do you think we're going? We're up to $40 billion in debt here. I mean, it's $40 trillion. I'm sorry. We're up in 2020, that number was 26.7. And here we are 6 years later, and we're at 40. Well, it's you know, a 50% pop in 6 years. We've been around here for like quite a while, right?
Well, there's a lot of controlled numbers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it, some of it was COVID. I looked at the last years, and...
means it was misguided, but okay.
Well, but here, just as a word of review, and I did it for myself, because I don't really, you know, even though we sort of remember, Kevin. 2020, it was $3.2 trillion. 2021, $2.8. 2022, $1.4. 2023, $1.7. 2024, 1.8. 2025, 1.8. And this year, 1.8 with 2 months to go. Now, when I say that, last year, September, was a credit. So it doesn't mean that it's going to be a lot worse than 1.8. I mean, it could be 2, but sure as hell isn't down at all. So we had the one kind of pause year between 2021 and 2022, and it was cut in half, and then it's been growing for a bit and then steady to slightly growing since. Yuck, eh?
Well, what did I tell you back in during the COVID nonsense?
A lot of stuff, most of it good.
A lot of stuff, but one of them was, let's just take for a minute, let's step back and assume, let's run with the assumption that we needed to do all this stuff and that we needed to do the deficit spending related to it. Let's just say, that's true as an assumption for a moment, because I don't think it was true, but nevertheless, that we had been so irresponsible in the previous decades that we couldn't afford to do this. You could take a big shock, a big situation like that, and you could say, okay, we have to do all this stuff, and we can put ourselves on a path to recover it over 10 years or whatever period of time it is. And you could rationally make that case. You can't rationally make that case when you're already starting with the level of debt that we have. And then to just pile on top of it just says we're so screwed. And so now you have people making policy. In fact, you have people making policy that they knew was wrong, and doing it anyway, and causing this kind of damage. And I have no idea how you get out of it. You know, other than crash and burn.
Boy, you know, I've been fighting with Carl for how many years thinking that there's a way for us
there
to...
There ain't no way.
I knew he's going to pop in there. I thought, let's say, 4 years ago when the argument was fresh, I actually thought... I mean, I got this question on Joel's thing yesterday as well, and he said, what about the inflation numbers? And I said, Joel, really, in terms of health of the population, and I can't believe I was quoting Carl on national TV. Yeah, I do, because Carl says some good stuff, and so do you, Kevin, even though I never give you the credit. I said, you know, here's my take on it, as an old monetarist. The problem people are having, generally, is for a 18-month period, we poured so much money in the system that we blew everybody's price up, you know, when everything filtered its way through the system, 35, 38, 40%, pick a number. It's never really been counted that way by the government, whoever administration's in there. So now we're left with this spot where there's this bubble where the pickup truck went from 65 to 85 in 3 years, and now it almost doesn't matter whether the inflation's 1 or 2%. The fact is people can't afford the pickup truck. But so going forward, the one way you could deal with it that I've been kind of preaching to Carl, and unfortunately he's been right, not me, the one way you could deal with it is if somehow you kept your inflation rate going forward at, say, 1%, and people's wages went up 3%, so meaning you had a real wage growth of 2%, and somehow you could catch up at least partially. But we're actually doing the opposite now. We're talking about the inflation rate it's admitted to is 3.4%, and I think, Carl, you're talking about wages are up too. So we're actually making it worse marginally, but we are absolutely not attacking the part that, and I gave the example, said, what if you parked in front of your house for free and all of a sudden it was $500, but then it stayed $500 for 10 years? Well, you got problems dealing with the 500. You're never going to catch up there. But, oh, by the way, in terms of inflation going forward, there isn't any. So it's all how you count the SIP. But with the fact that the people are in trouble is because of this bulge. And, you know, I've got, you know, money supply up from 2020. At the end of 2020 was $15 trillion, and now it's 23. Well, that's, what is that? That's 55% increase. I mean, that's a huge number. So I don't know how you... I keep trying to find ways, and I'm hoping to get one out of you, Kevin. There's a way we can do this without some massive sort of crash, because that's going to cause problems too. Way big problems.
I mean, it will. And you know, Tom, one of the reasons that responsible people are frugal in their real life is to be able to account for and deal with emergency situations. We did not do that as it pertained to government, and we are going to pay a severe price for that.
Well, I bet you could look at, matter of fact, Dr. Jay and I had this discussion, God, it had to be 40 years ago. You could look at the best years. You know, maybe Indiana's a little different. You could look at the absolute best years of the U.S. government, certainly of Illinois. I'll probably lob Chicago in there. I don't know about suburbs. The single best economic years, where there was no crazy storms, no hurricanes, no nothing, and every dime was spent in those years, which is exactly what you're saying, Kevin. And so all of a sudden we got a bad year next year, and we go, wait a minute, well, don't you expect a bad year once in a while? Is there any sort of a thing of a rainy day fund? No, we'll spend that too.
How about the number of governors who, you know, the states just got tons of COVID money, and they didn't use it all on COVID-related stuff, and so it was like, I have some money to burn, so they spent it. Well, okay, that's not, you know, that's not responsible, but it's what makes it even worse is they spent it on initiatives that required ongoing budgetary spending that was not part of their one-time funding. And so now, you know, we see that in Indiana, where what was the governor before Braun? I can't remember his name.
I should remember the name, but I don't.
Newcomb. Gavin Newcomb. I've got a picture of his face in my mind, and I want to throw a pie in it.
Is it a nice face? Is it a nice face?
He was a good-looking man and all, but I still want to give him a pie in the face.
Well, there you go.
But the point that I'm making is that he, by spending some of that money, committed the state to a lot of ongoing spending to maintain whatever investments, quote, you know, I hate to use the word investments because investments would require some kind of positive return, but would require some kind of ongoing spending, and that forced Braun to come in and start doing a whole bunch of budget cuts that have been really, really difficult for some people to swallow. Some parts of the organization, I'm seeing it in the education side.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know in Chicago they couldn't wait to give away the last part of dough. I mean, some places, I think if you paid down the debt with the extra, it's probably not so bad. But I don't know how many people did that.
Fine, but that's not what happened.
No. So you're saying, actually, pretty wisely, there's a difference between just throwing some money at something and throwing some money at something that you got to keep doing it every year when you don't have the dough.
Yeah, and thanks to Joe for telling me it was Eric Holcomb.
Okay. When was by a governor? Is that how many years ago was that? He was one of them. He was a governor at one point, wasn't he?
Talking decades here.
All right. Then the same guy became a senator, right, for a while? Or was that the kid? I don't remember. They're friends of John Short, I know. They're Notre Dame fans, I think, the Byes. They're big Notre Dame guys. I don't know if they went there or not, but Indiana kind of is going back and forth, Republican, Democrat, haven't they, in the governor's spot?
No, it's been Republicans for a long time, but it's been, you know, different versions of Republicans. So before Holcomb was Mike Pence, and Pence was, you know, not, I can't say I like him, but he was a good administrator. He took over for Mitch Daniels, and Mitch Daniels, I thought, was a very good governor. And then before that was a Democrat, it was Joe Kernan. You know, he was kind of a temporary. It was O'Bannon before that. So, yeah, they had a run of Democrats before they getting a run of Republicans.
Well, Mike Pence was pretty solid, wasn't he?
Mitch Daniels was good. Pence kind of maintained status quo until he became vice president, and then Holcomb came along, and Holcomb is technically a Republican, but I don't really consider him a Republican.
Well, I don't think Mike Pence did any of this on purpose, but I read how many pensions the guy gets. Wasn't he like a state rep?
He was in Congress for a long time. He was a congressman.
But I think he was a state something. Then he was in Congress. Then he was a governor. And then he was vice. But he gets like, I'm going to say, five pensions or something. Not that he doesn't deserve it. He did all that stuff, but it's really kind of odd when you think about it.
Yeah, you know, I have my thoughts of what Pence can do to himself. So,
you know, I thought he was, you know, I don't know him anywhere near as well as you, but I never thought he was all that bad. I mean, it personally seemed like he was pretty solid. But, my question is, which I don't know him enough to know whether good or bad. So I guess you obviously don't think he did some bad stuff. What do you think it was?
Well, first of all, his agenda was primarily right-wing religious, and not that I have a problem with religious people at all. I have a lot of respect for religious people, even though I'm not one of them. But it should not be your political agenda. So I think you have that issue with Pence. We've been talking a lot about globalists lately, and he is definitely in that camp. So he's part of who's responsible. I keep talking about globalists in that I think that's who's responsible for hollowing out a lot of the middle class and the middle class jobs that go with it. So, it's been an intentional. We killed ourselves on purpose, you know, which just is sad, I think.
Well, when you say that, I keep threatening, and I'm going to do it one of these days. I'm going to read the page where Harold Janin, ITT, one of the first globalists, his view of the world, and it's exactly the same as these guys. Their view is when you say we, Kevin, and I'm not going to give the floor euphemism. What do you got, a mouse in your pipe? When Harold Janin or somebody who's got a company in 18 different spots, I don't think they think of it at all. Why should I pay Social Security in these assholes' country when I don't have to pay it over here? And these guys are not as quite as productive, but they're willing to work for half. So what? Why should I pay some goofball in Chicago this and Social Security and a pension when I can pay these other guys something else and people buy the same crap? And oh, by the way, I'll try and keep competition against me as low as I can through every means I possibly can, so nobody can even compete with me. To their mind, they're just doing good business. And you're in my mind, it's borderline bound for hell stuff. I love people to compete. I mean, hell, I did that for 20 years on the trading floor. But these guys, they don't ever want to compete. In their opinion, competition is the best thing in the world for everybody else but you, right?
Yeah, I understand, but then we have to have, you know, policy that makes it really, really hard to outsource jobs.
Which is pretty hard.
And we've talked about that with H-1Bs, but we've talked about that with all kinds of other aspects of it as well. I still encourage you to look up, you know, Hamiltonian economics, because that is built very much around using tariffs to spur the manufacturing base in the company.
I have no...
I know you were raised, you know, through Notre Dame economics program and University of Chicago, and so your first reaction to anything tariffs is that tariffs are bad. And I'm kind of getting to the point where I don't necessarily think that.
I didn't say I wasn't there, Kevin, to be honest with you. in some of these specific spots, I think if we're going to have a tariff, they have it only on goods and not services, to me, is asinine. When services are things we're bitching about, right?
Services is some of what you're bitching
about. Well, I mean, if we're offloading computer people, I don't necessarily have an issue with somebody coming to school here or whatever, learning stuff and wanting to get a job here, but he's got to enter the fray normally. The idea that Carl talks about, he goes back to China or India and comes back as an indentured servant from some company that can pay him less than somebody here, and oh, by the way, he can't even go down the block and get the market wage somewhere else. That, to me, is absolutely appalling. I don't know where you put that. I mean, that to me is those guys, the globalists in control of the government, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I mean, when you say tariffs to a certain extent, and I'm not. By the way, the Hamiltonian group, those are the guys. The original tariffs were to put in their mind was to get the U.S. essentially up to speed in the garment industry that was controlled by Britain. So the
wasn't entirely in the garment industry, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, they originally, the machines and everything were all in Britain. We had to export all our cotton and everything over there, but they did all the weaving and all that kind of stuff. But I don't have necessarily what I have a problem with is a general tariff, because you're spending so much money and telling people that the general tariff is a tax on the other people and not you. I have a problem with that lie. I mean, if we're going to even something up, you're never going to get me to not agree that. Wait a minute. You got a factory. You can't pour, you know, a bunch of crap in the Rio Grande from our side. But oh, by the way, you go across the river and pour it in from the other side. Well, guess what? It gets in the same river. I mean, I don't have any problem with you know, Carl's idea of, wait a minute, we got to even this up somehow, whether it's tariffs or something. You're not going to get that argument out of me. But just don't tell me that the tax is on somebody else and not on me. And oh, by the way, put one out there that was done improperly. It didn't go through Congress. So all of a sudden it gets reversed. And now a bunch of people are getting the money back, and you and I aren't. And then we're going to do it all over again. I mean, neither one of us would write fiction like that. You know, if we're going to do it, let's do it right. Let's do it for a reason. I can roll with that. Pollution, I think, is a very big reason. People working under age 16 is a very big reason. I'm kind of with you, and I'm not as
absolute. Labor is a big reason. So is as far as I'm concerned, is what kinds of products are important to our well-being as a country.
We've always done that.
Well, not really. If we had always done that, then we wouldn't have so many of our pharmaceuticals made in China. We wouldn't have all kinds of military parts made overseas, like in places like China. We may have always done that to protect the airline industry, or the not the airline industry, the
yes, the airlines,
plane manufacturers. But no, we haven't always done that. We let stuff get completely out of control.
Let me rephrase. We have a pattern, a history of doing that, not always wisely and not always in the right spots. We clearly have done it in sugar. We clearly have done it in timber. We've done it in a lot of spots, just like Japan has done in rice and other kinds of things. But does that mean we did it well and did it in the right industries, or we did it in the industries that had the most influence, right? I mean, there was a time when sugar had a lot more industry than, you know, is there a time and place for it? I'm with you. Now the question is, who decides what the time and place is? I mean, obviously we've dropped the ball here, haven't we?
I'm saying
we did it with sugar. We forgot to do it for a couple of things that you mentioned, and did we forget, or did somebody get paid off not to do it? I mean, why is it that the stuff you're talking about, you know, how did we let the pharmaceutical stuff get overseas when we obviously, it looks like we care more about sugar than we do drugs, right?
It's not as simple as to say we did it for cheap labor, because we also did it, to avoid different kinds of regulations. We outsourced our pollution, for example, and some of those other things, and you just highlighted that a minute ago.
Yeah, do I think that there's more? Of course, I don't know about today, Kevin. Since we seem to be firing people and doing so, I don't know. I would bet that there's more rodent hairs in the penicillin factory in India than if we had one here. I'm just going to bet that. I don't know if I'd win. We'd have to go check. I don't know if I want to go check. Do you?
Yeah, I don't want to find them. I don't want to deal with them.
If I want to find a rodent, all I got to do is go to my alley.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, but you know, these are what you're. I think what we're both nipping at, Kevin, is in for a long period of time. It seems like every level of government has really sort of let us down in a lot of ways. A lot of the companies that left Chicago, and I know it always sounds like I'm jumping around, but it's really sort of the same subject. A lot of the manufacturing companies that left Chicago were because people found holes in the pension laws. And whenever you had, and when Kevin and I were very young, the pensions were companies had defined benefit plans, and they ponied up the money. Well, when we went, like I said, I really believe that everything we talk about essentially piles into something else. When the interest rates went to 12 or 14 or 15%, every pension plan was amazingly oversubscribed in terms of money. And our government, whether you're lefty or right or wherever the hell you are, our government with the ERISA laws said that a company cannot peel money back from the pension fund if it became oversubscribed. So somebody said, well, but some assholes said, wait a minute, if I take over a company and basically get rid of everybody, I can then buy them an annuity based on what their pension is, and I can just grab the oversubscription. And Pullman was one of the first model cases of that. And our idiots, maybe influenced by Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, who put these deals together, said, wait a minute, that's not what we want to have happen. Instead, how many companies went the way of the dodo bird in Chicago, Kevin? United Airlines being one, right? United Airlines used to be a company. Then it became, what, United Inc. or something? They actually bought their own subsidiary and raided the fund?
It
was UAL. Now it's what, United Inc. But this happened to the steel companies. Steel companies were incredibly oversubscribed. And through a group of mergers, there's steel companies that didn't even have any money left in the pension that the government is paying their pension. I mean, Kevin, this has happened. The failure of our people to take care of the middle class and other things. God, I could rant for a 5-hour show on that and never stop talking, which I don't want to do and nobody wants to hear. I mean, when you talk about it today, this has been a 50-year plan, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what I say. We did it. It's all been done intentionally. There's a difference between intent and intentionally, but you know, this was everything that is an outcome of that was a predictable outcome, just like much in the same way that when Obamacare passed, everything that has happened to, has happened since then has been a predictable outcome. Lots of people predicted exactly what was going to happen, and it did. So, it's not like, are people just too stupid to ignore these signs, or are too ideological to believe them, or are they so damn cynical and so damn mean-spirited that they're saying, screw them, do it anyway? I think there's a whole element of screw them, do it anyway. I see that shit in the immigration policy of recent years. I think that was all about, well, screw them. Who cares? Who cares about the lower end of the economic spectrum and providing jobs for them? Screw them. We'll just bring in cheaper labor than that. And more of it, and drive down the cost of labor. I think it's all the same stuff. And yeah, I think there is definitely a mean aspect or a cynical aspect. You can call it whatever you want, But you know, that's sort of built into.
Nobody wants to admit a mistake. I think is what it is, Kevin. I mean, nobody.
Yeah, that's part of it.
I mean, I don't know where to go back. You know, obviously this is a big deal for me because I work for Pullman. I don't know where. Let's say this, and if Carl has an opinion, please. Where in the government, at that point, when somebody sees this as, quote, an unintended consequence, okay, wait a minute, the current firm can't adjust their stuff, but a new guy can essentially raid it. Somebody sees that loophole. Okay, and I'm not, you know, I was a young guy, and I saw it. But, you know, I wasn't the brightest. Still aren't. Somebody somewhere in government, unless they're all, God knows, doing covering their ass all day long so they can't think, somebody spotted it. Now, did they not walk into the Oval Office or the Speaker of the House or somebody and say, hey, wait a minute, this is not what we intended? Now, clearly, once it happened, the Goldmans of the world and the Solomon brothers saw this as the pot of gold in the rainbow, right? All of a sudden, places that never even dreamed they were gonna have these takeover deals, or all of a sudden they're going to have them. Now, where is the person who should have walked into the Oval Office or something and said, hey, whoever the hell you are at the time, whoever was Carter, or God knows who, or it wasn't Carter, before Carter, probably was Nixon. Hey, Tricky Dick or Jerry Ford, this wasn't supposed to happen.
Yes, it was.
Or maybe it was. You know, or maybe... Yes, no,
yes,
no.
Yes, no, I'm sorry. You need to... You have a blind spot that is 100 miles wide on this, Chief, and this isn't the first time you've exhibited it either. If you think that the people, well, hell, let's just take Obamacare, okay?
All right, well, stay on the pension one, because I know some about
that.
No, hold
on, because they're related. They are absolutely related. Because in the case of Obamacare, the guy who actually wrote it a few years afterwards, when people said, oh, by the way, everybody's getting it in their back door because of the monopolistic pricing that it enabled, and oh, by the way, it made illegal places like the Oklahoma Surgery Center, so you can't open another one. Couldn't force that one to close, but what you could do is make it against the law for anyone to set up another one, and they did. And oh, that was an unintended consequence. He said, no, it wasn't. It was not an unintended consequence. It was a inherent part of the structure, and I'm the guy that actually did it, and I did it on purpose.
Okay,
now, do you think that the people that put this together with the mergers so that you could steal the pension fund, you really don't think that they did that intentionally?
Okay, take it from the beginning. And I know I have a blind spot, but it's not 100 miles wide. Here's what happened, and our late contributor to the show, Robin, who got killed in the car accident, was on the pension board of Pullman. And the people who were on the pension board were in those days, were very serious people, because you're talking about everybody's being able to eat 30 years from
well,
now.
Well, yeah.
Right? Okay, so what Robin said, the hardest thing they did, that they would have experts come in and blah, blah, blah. What rate can we count on making money going forward that we don't ever underfund this thing?
Right.
And but the numbers, you guys would be stunned at the numbers. The numbers were like 4. And if you went to 5, because how much did the market used to go up in those days? 4 or 5. How much were you getting in risk-free rate? 4 or 5. Okay, and all of a sudden, anything you had in a bond, you're making 15 for 6-7 years. And yep. Now all of a sudden you got all this dough. Okay, those people didn't expect, and maybe the guys at Goldman Sachs were smart enough to know that given what they were doing with the money supply at the time, those rates were going to do that. But the people who were on these boards, because just to fill in the blanks, what would happen is they would pick a rate, okay? Then you have your actuaries say, well, okay, based on your 2,000 people at work here, these people are going to make it to 60, 65, 70, 70. This is how many years you have to pay. So then you take those two together and you say, all right, we need X number of dollars 40 years from now. We need to make this contribution this year. So the people who did it, I think, were pretty legit. Now, as to the unintended consequence is, was somebody smart enough to say, well, based on our money supply stuff, I don't think so. We're going to cause this inflation in the next 10 years, and these things are all going to be oversubscribed. Now, I don't know that anybody was that smart, Carl. Maybe they were, but once it started to happen, it was pretty obvious what was happening and what was the fix. No, wait a minute. You guys can draw some money out because you're the ones who paid too much in and not just the next guy. The fix didn't come, is what happened in that area. So that area I know something about. The fix should have been, wait a minute, Pullman, you can take the $40 million out because you're the one who put too much in, not let the next guy come and grab it.
Well, but the problem, and the proof that this was premeditated comes when the change shows up, okay? The all of a sudden, you've got this overfunded thing, all right, at least on today's numbers, right? I mean, no guarantee they're going to stay that way, duh. But on today's numbers, they are, okay?
Well, if you're counting on four and you're getting 15, you're oversubscribed for a while.
More than a little, yeah. Right? Okay, so, and then, so now you have this. By the way, these are, for the most part, public companies. Therefore, this is in the quarterly and the annual reports, right? It's in the K's and the Q's, all right? It's there. It's visible to everyone, all right? And 15 minutes after the first couple of those show up, there is not a bill shoved through both the House and the Senate and on the President's desk that signed that says, you can't raid that.
Right. That's my point. You can't raid it.
Now, that it was intentionally planned to be abused, the proof is right there.
Well, I mean, I think with the Obamacare situation, this is my big... Everybody thinks I'm this flaming liberal. That's why I didn't vote for Obama a second time. When he said... we're going to have competition among the insurance companies originally in that plan, I was all for it. I'm thinking, well, that's terrific. But then what happened? There were 70 or 75 mergers in the insurance companies in like 6 months, so the whole idea of the insurance exchange got dropped. And my big bitch with Obama was, wait a minute, this guy has to notice this. He has to change his bill because the signature part of this bill that it's going to be competitive isn't anymore. How does he not see it?
It wasn't designed to be that.
It was never. Exactly, Kevin. It was never. And the guy who wrote the thing came out a couple of years later after it was passed and admitted it.
Okay.
Yeah, you're talking about Jonathan Gruber, who's an MIT economist.
Yes.
And his famous quote is that they were counting on the stupidity of the American voter.
Ding, 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 ding.
And really, the design of it and the design of everything around the exchanges was for it to fail. It was built around... Obama didn't want to do the Cadillac tax, the Cadillac plan tax, until Gruber convinced him that what would happen if you did that and tied the threshold to the rate of inflation, that year by year, that we would start taxing the hell out of plans that companies were still wanted to offer until it was not economical for them to do so, and that they would throw their employees into the exchanges. And they would keep throwing them in there. The exchanges wouldn't work under that kind of stress, and that they would then, we would be in position to go to single payer administered by the government. That was the plan. That's people's words on the record.
Everyone that runs around, there were some problems with it, but the original implementation was designed to help people. That was absolute crap.
You guys are pinning me here as being a defender. I'm not a defender. That's why I didn't vote for the guy. But I'm saying if it was me, the telltale sign it wasn't what I wanted. I won't assume that he wanted it, but if it was me, I would say, wait a minute, we're already off track. What's going on here? Because I really wanted it to become more competitive, and I thought there was a way to do that, but obviously it didn't go that way.
Yeah, well, but obviously it didn't go that way because it was deliberately designed not to go that way.
He let the lobbyists get too close. He never addressed cost, which was totally foolish.
Chief, he never intended to do any of those things.
Okay.
At no time did Barack Obama intend to do any of it. that you say was the goal.
Yeah, the goal, pathway into single payer.
The entire intent was to destroy what was, the system was in the process of collapsing. It was absolutely in the process of doing that. It was the terminal end of what I started raising hell about in the 1990s when I had to write the checks as an employer and a CEO and saw both the degradation of the quality of what we were able to provide to employees and the double-digit annual increase in expense that we were being forced to absorb.
Well, that's because you were insuring, you and PTI were insuring other people.
Well, I understand that, yeah. But I'm saying that we saw that going on, and I started raising hell about it at the time and said, this is absolutely going to blow up in everybody's face. There is no way around it. By the way, the same problem is in Medicare and Medicaid, so this is right, the whole thing.
For listeners that don't know what the hell we're talking about, is when Carl writing this check and at PTI us writing the check, if you'd have gone into, pick a date, 1995, if you'd have gone into a hospital, or not gone in, just analyze the hospital, you would see some people with these. The insurance was essentially, spread out in the hospital, right, guys? I mean, if you had this, quote, Cadillac plan, whatever bill they sent you, your guy paid it. And oh, by the way, if you had a baby, you walked out the door with $200 a package thing of diapers. Okay, so there was that group that the hospital made hay on, big time. Yeah. Then there was the next group where the insurance companies had some sort of negotiated stuff for some things, but still if something else happened, you could pile on that. So they were kind of half-assed getting reamed, basically. Then there was the next group where everything might have been negotiated. Then you was your Medicare, which maybe you broke even on. Then there was the Medicaid underneath that they got $100 a day, whether you didn't do anything to them or whether you did brain surgery. So, and then there was somebody who didn't pay at all. So the hospital essentially had to charge people way more, and that was falling apart, which is what Carl's talking about. The healthcare was being essentially apportioned by individual hospitals based on how much the individual people there were paying. Had nothing to do with cost, and everybody, still doesn't. Anybody, and you paying for what you got done. Some people couldn't pay, and some people paid 10 times as much, right? And that was all falling apart. Isn't that what you're talking about, Carl?
Well, yeah. Essentially, you had, as often happens in the political sphere in the United States, and has happened for a long time, you have a few people who have something very bad occur. Okay? So we had what led to all the screaming and with EMTALA and laws like it was that you had a handful of people who literally got dumped while they were in extremis in some way because they had no money and no ability to pay and no insurance. Okay, so this happens in a handful of instances. It's not common, but it does occur. The howling from people, oh, you can't let that happen. Okay?
I believe the terminology is we must make sure this never happens again.
This never occurs again. Okay? So, you start larding up the game. And the people who are professional poverty pimps that are into this because they make a hell of a lot of money, get out there and add on to the rage bait and everything. God, it's 100 times worse today because now we got an internet. Back then we didn't. And you end up with policies that end up lining their pockets and don't actually help anybody. And we've seen that repeatedly. But in the healthcare environment, this had run its course. We'd gone as far as we could reasonably go with the system that we had, and it was in the process of coming apart. I raised a huge amount of noise about it in the 1990s because I was one of the people that had to write the checks, and I saw it going on, and I knew exactly where it was going to go. And I had several wars with the insurers that were covering my employees.
Well, we were 40% women of childbearing age and 40% older guys. How do you think our bill looked?
Well, yeah, about like mine, okay? I had 18-year-olds and, 18 to 20-year-olds that were part-timers or full-timers, but were still electing to take the insurance because they had something. Okay, you know, you're going to college, but you're this was before you could be, you know, the companies were forced to keep you on the parents' policies and things like this. But you're out of the house. Okay, you're an independent adult. So I had people like that, and they, for the most part, they were quite cheap. Okay, especially the guys. The girls, not so much, but the guys, were, if they were in good health, were cheap. But then I also had people who were highly valuable employees, people that were older, say, for example, older women, a 45-year-old woman who, boy, oh boy, that, you know, second to one who is still of childbearing age, that's the next category, right, of how you get bent over the table. And, oh, by the way, maybe she's heavy on top of it, right? I had a range of cost on a monthly basis because unknown to most people. Oh, everyone's getting charged the same. Oh, no, they're not. I had that spreadsheet on my desk every month because I had to write the check on the bottom of the line. There was a disparity of cost 10 times from the least expensive to the most, and yet ERISA prohibited me from assessing that back against the people who were higher cost. It was illegal for me to do it. All right? So, the problem with that...
insurance used to mean all for one and one for all, not anymore.
Well, but here's the problem with that, Chief. Okay, if I take that, and now I have, say, in an office of, say, 30 people, I have two or three of them that are in that stupidly expensive category, all right? Essentially, I'm stealing a dollar an hour of everyone's wage that is a healthy 20-year-old.
Well, when you were 20, you didn't mind because when you...
No. When I was 20, I didn't know.
Well, but I mean, you also didn't mind because the idea was when I get to be 65, it'll be the same way. But now it's not.
Well, guess what? That was never going to hold up. And anyone that could use a calculator in 15 seconds of brain power knew that.
But at the price at the time, you know what? In my first clerk I hired, I'm going to say 1982. You know what it cost me for insurance for him and his family?
Yeah, basically nothing.
$75 a month.
Yeah.
I mean, that I could afford easily back then, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah. No, Chief, I understand this, okay? Here's the thing, though. When you did that, all right, when that person needed to go to the doctor, they walked in the doctor's office and wrote a check.
Yeah.
All right? What was the insurance there for? If you got cancer or you got in a car accident and you're all smashed up and they need to set four bones in your leg.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, that was what it was for. It wasn't so that every...
Routine visits. It wasn't your wellness visit.
Well, your so-called wellness visit, which, by the way, they now have it, and incidentally, there was a really serious issue that showed up immediately, which is one of the reasons that they didn't want the Surgery Center of Oklahoma to have it. They didn't want any more of those, and that was that if you go into the Surgery Center in Oklahoma, it's a soup to nuts price, and you pay up front, okay. If they screw up and give you an infection in the hospital, they get to eat it. Whereas if you go into a conventional hospital and that happens, you pay for it. You pay for the fact that they broke you while you were there. And
but you're saying you're not paying for it, insurance is paying for it, which is part of the problem.
My insurance isn't paying for it, you're paying for it, because guess whose bill goes up next year for the insurance?
Okay, but it's an indirect...
It still comes out of my pocket.
Well, eventually, yeah, but...
Hello. So, and oh, by the way, what if the original thing didn't absorb all of my, my maximum annual amount, and yet after they gave me the infection, all of a sudden it does?
Well,
that comes directly out of my pocket.
There's economics to this. And
the first one is you throw everybody in jail to charge.
Well, but I'm saying your problem. A lot of the problem is one of overhead. I mean, again, I go back to my roots being a cost account. When I go to the dentist, I go, for those that don't care, I get my teeth cleaned four times a year, because way back in the day I had some gum surgery. And the guy said, if you never want to go through it again, just get your teeth cleaned every 3 months instead of every 6 months. And I've been doing that forever, and guess what? He was right. So when I go, the guy charges me $150. I write him a check, or I put in my credit card. Now, how much cheaper is that than me buying insurance for somebody else to pay for my teeth to get cleaned, to go in and have a copay of $50, and now he's got to do 15 different letters back and forth, or not letters anymore. Why do all these other people have to get involved? That has to double the cost.
Well, Chief,
than me just writing the check.
Why do you think there's an entire building next door to the hospital full of people that have never seen a person and provided a single second of assistance to a single person? All they've done is stick it in their butt and collect money.
In your world, it's people next door in a building. In my world, it's overhead.
Well, you know what? In my world, it's a nice target for an A-10 Warthog.
Well, why anybody would want insurance on something that's routine, I have no idea.
Because that way they think they don't have to pay for it.
The only intelligent part of that was, and I think to this day it made some sense. Now, of course, it probably got abused. I think it was a good idea for, I do think there is something to preventative medicine, or at least getting some kind of a baseline, you know, what your blood is normally and blah, blah, so you can tell when things change. You know, I'm no doctor, but I think the idea of the insurance maybe covering and wanting you to go to a physical every couple of years is probably not a bad idea. And some people are cheap enough that even if it's $200 aren't going to go. So I think to a certain extent something like that maybe makes some sense. Maybe if it's not abused. But what doesn't get abused, for God's sake?
Well, there's one of your big problems there, right? But that's, here's the basic. The basic problem is this. The entire premise of insurance is the pooling of risk. Okay? I mean, that's the whole premise. You have fire insurance on your house because it is extremely unlikely that you will have a fire. But if you do have a fire, it's a cost you cannot bear.
Right.
All right? That is the entire reason you have it. As soon as that becomes a forced purchase, and it doesn't matter in what context it becomes a forced purchase, as soon as that occurs, all premise of competition disappears. And by the way, so does the reason for you not to store 5 gallons of gasoline in your living room and play with matches.
Well, especially if you don't like your house anymore.
Well...
Or your boat, Mr. Yachtsman.
Well, or your boat, right. I mean...
There's a hurricane coming. I think I'll just leave this thing right here.
But by the way, that's not a... That sounds funny, but it actually isn't funny.
I didn't intend it to be funny.
Oh, no, it used to happen all the time. When I lived down in Florida, there were brokerages that were notorious for doing this kind of thing. And the lovely acts of our government made storm damage a no-fault, no-cure kind of circumstance, except if you could prove gross negligence. So these guys would go up around the corner into a cove, drop a single grossly underweight anchor with a ridiculously undersized anchor line for the size of the vessel in question. They would not put out a Bahamian mooring, which for those who don't know, is 3 anchors. They would not put a proper bridle out. They wouldn't put out, none of the things that you would take windage down, take your enclosures and stuff like this down.
Leave the sail up?
Well, they wouldn't go quite that far. But yes, effectively, okay, they wouldn't take the windage down and take those kinds of precautions. Of course, then what happens is, as expected, the boat breaks free in the storm. And if it was just that boat, I'd just kind of sit there and chuckle.
How long did it take for the guy next door to him to get the guy's boat out of his swimming pool? Was it like 6 months?
That's exactly the problem. So then what really happens is that boat's a pinball.
Yeah.
Okay? In a pinball machine, because there's a bunch of other boats. And it ends up in somebody's house, it ends up in their swimming pool, it ends up on their dock, or yours is out there, properly secured, it smashes into yours and destroys it. Okay, and you did the right sort of things. But you get destroyed because somebody else was an idiot.
Well, the conversation kind of goes all the same way, and it's always kind of a different topic, but the same topic. The question is, when you have some sorts of, there's two issues. I mean, there's a lot of issues, but what Kevin was alluding to, and you guys a little bit on the Obamacare, and I'm not going to debate you with that. The original idea, I thought, made some sense, and as it went onward, I've said 100 times, it went onward, I got horrified, and I didn't vote for the guy again. So it wasn't like I didn't come along, but the other part is there are things that are unintended. You know, like I think the pension, all of a sudden, wait a minute, people are making 14% on interest, nobody planned on that. Or where's all this extra dough, what's going to happen? Well, as soon as somebody sees something untoward happen there, which, of course, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and Salomon Brothers might love, somebody somewhere's job monitoring things is to say, wait a minute, this isn't what we intended. By the way, on a recent occurrence on this, well, recent to us, the 2007-2008 fiasco.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody, even you guys, you know, who are smart dudes, will immediately drop back to, you know, the stewardess put down too little money and should not have bought the house. Okay, I get that. But that had really something to do with the Armageddon that happened. The Armageddon that happened was a boatload of people borrowing money at 2% in Japan and piling them into mortgages here at 6.5% and making more money than God because it's all levered money.
I mean, well, Carol, now wait a minute.
Okay, what I'm saying is there were 35 hours of leverage sitting on every one of the stewardesses' house dollars.
I get that, Chief, but here's the problem. The stewardess couldn't have gotten a loan without the fraud.
Okay, but I think that's necessary. We're going to disagree on it. My point is,
well, no.
Somebody in government, somebody in the Fed, some of the people we pay, should have sat there. Then they are privy to these numbers that even though you get more numbers than I do, you're not privy to them. Somewhere along the line, somebody's going to say, boy, you know, looks to me like all these loan things, some of them are even synthetic because the demand was more than the houses.
Right.
I mean, this money is all coming from China. Somebody at the Fed or the Treasury Department's got to say, well, wait a minute, that's not intended. How the hell is that happening?
And
that's when the guy from Goldman or Morgan walks in and says, we're making a fortune on this. Somehow or another, when things... There used to be... Boy, I'm really showing...
But Chief, it was intended because the guys on the trading desk at Goldman... And
it wasn't intended by me.
Well, it wasn't intended by you, but it was intended by them because it was later proved when people started suing, when it blew up in their face, that these guys were having conversations back and forth in their internal systems, calling all of these packaged up things because they knew what was in the portfolio. They were calling it vomit. Well, and yet they were out there selling it to customers as good investments.
I sort of get that, but now listen where I'm coming with this. You know, I was in the business a long time before that. And there were times when some company is just so cheap you can't wait to get in on it, right? There's been a few times even I wanted to do that. And I at the time I'm sitting there going, why is there such demand for 6.5% paper? It's not that much. I mean, Goldman Sachs, the signature one that blew up over in Europe, there wasn't a mortgage in there. They were all synthetic. The demand.
I know it was all synthetic crap.
But everybody got the idea of the carry trade.
Right.
Everybody said, if I can borrow money at 2% in Japan, and Carl and I can, well, would have been a lot of money, still kind of a lot of money. We pieced together $1 million and borrowed 30 at 2% and put it in 6.5% mortgages. Carl, even you and I can make some dough doing that. I mean,
by the way, that carry trade's still there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still going on.
So, well, a little less, but yeah. Now, what are we missing? We're missing the part about taking the dollars back to the yen, right? Because if we did that. So, this thing is way bigger than anybody. Now, why would if the mortgage rates were 15%, I could be coerced, but at 6.5, I, at the time, I'm going, what is wrong with this? How could this, Chief,
the only reason it works is because you could recycle it through three or four different times, or however many you were willing, however big your balls were. And by the way, the reason that that happens is as I'm sure you know, because you were in a business, and I wrote up a bunch of articles about it at the time. The reason it happens is because the required holdback, the haircut, if you will, within institutions, and by the way, all of this is stuff that the Federal Reserve is well aware of, as is the ECB, as is the Japanese Central Bank, the JGB. All of these guys, the required reserve, if any of it has a treasury connection, is zero. And therefore, I can do these turns as many times as I'm willing.
Can you imagine how much money Goldman and Morgan were making on all these? They got a piece of everything.
Well, I know exactly how much they were making because it was all showing up in their 10-Ks and their 10-Qs.
They're making money on the currency transaction. They're making money on the borrowing in Japan. They're making money everywhere. They're into it like three times.
The problem is they're not making money. You realize that, right?
What do you mean?
What do I mean?
If
I take $100 out of your pocket, I'm not making $100.
If somebody ponies up a certain amount of money, and I take a 0.5% of the currency transaction, that 0.5% is mine, bud.
Well, right, it is. But you took it from somebody, didn't you?
Well, they wanted me to.
That's all fine as long as everyone is doing that with reasonable and fair disclosure. That wasn't happening.
Right. Well, I mean, that transaction happens a zillion times a day.
All I'm pointing out is that when there is fraud involved, okay, which there was, that is no longer a consensual transaction.
But I'm saying
if you have a steer that you just slaughtered and you sell me some steak, we have a consensual transaction there, right?
Without a doubt. But I mean,
that's fine.
I'm saying there were pieces to it that people never. It's sort of like if you get a house from somebody. And oh, by the way, the guy's going to put the money in the title company. Okay, that's another little piece he gets.
Right.
I'm saying a lot of these, there were like two or three legitimate transactions. Anyway, we've got to go to break here. But there were two or three legitimate transactions that they were on all sides of that stuff. They were on the currency.
I understand. Yeah, I understand that. I'm just saying that the whole thing was essentially, you know, there were enough areas where it was laced with fraud that it was ridiculous.
But, you know, it's still sort of there in the municipal bond market.
Well, okay, that's true. But you know what? I saw a lot of this in the run-up to the blow-up because I was in one of the hot spots for it, okay, in Florida. And there were people that I knew that had under 100 grand of income, real income, okay, that had several million dollars worth of real estate outstanding on stated income loans.
Okay, yeah, without a doubt.
And then when it blew up in their face, by the way, there was no set of reasonable underwriting under which those loans were legitimate, okay? They were and then, of course, it was someone else's fault when it exploded in their face and all of a sudden everyone's after them.
I had dinner one night with a client, I was younger, and she was pretty easy on the eyes, and let's say her girlfriend was very, very easy on the eyes. And she was a stewardess, flight attendant now. She got promoted. She's sitting there, I got like five houses, and I almost, a good thing I wasn't drinking my wine. I might have spit,
you would have spit it out, right? Yeah. Like,
you got what? What
the hell did you do? Yeah.
I'm like, SP Futures up 9, NASDAQ Futures up 88. Say, if I didn't have a girlfriend, I'd have been interested. She's not only gorgeous, she's got dough. But maybe a year later, she shouldn't have any dough. But we'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Loading up back Stocks and Jocks. Half time out, Ricky on the board. S&P Futures up 8, NASDAQ Futures up 86, piling on to record highs. And we're going to go into the valuations on this in a minute with Carl. We're going to keep, I guess that's kind of the theme this week. We have over in Europe. We got the Dow is down 89. Individual stocks, not much. Google's down up 94 cents. It's about a real quiet Dow here this morning. Really, really kind of quiet everywhere. Micron's up another $30. It's almost pushing 1,000 again. Wow, that's all I'll say about that one as well. The prices were coming down according to Carl a while ago, and now they're right back up again. It appears. Even though the China guys came out and said they were going to do it cheaper, it affects everybody for a couple days, and they go right back up again. DAX up 217.8%. FTSE up 2, call that flat. CAC up 4, call that flat. So the DAX is loving the world, and FTSE and CAC are just kind of nothing. Over in Asia, Nikkei up 405.6%. They're back trading. They weren't trading for a couple of days. Hang Seng down 279. It's 1.1%. Shanghai up 21, let's call that, actually up 21 cents, so call that one flat. So Hang Seng to the downside, the other guys are kind of flat. Bonds, 4.63, so we've come down a little on the interest rate since these two CPI and PPI came out, both of which hit energy is the big reason why they're down, but energy's back up in the last 2 weeks, and Carl's going to tell us when they take that measure, because clearly, gas is higher than it was a month ago, but in the middle of the month, it was down, I think. The bond up 1 basis point, 3.15. Japan, 2.88. So the carry trade is still there. It's not half a 1% anymore. It's 2.88. So it's real over there, interest rates. Oil up 64 cents, 81.89. RBOB, 3.12. So again, add whatever your tax is to that. You're probably 410, 420, 390, depending on the state. Gold up $15, 44.36. Silver up 13 cents, 65.12. Foreign exchange, this is the number we're looking at. The euro is 115.7, so it's kind of in the middle of this range. It's not as low as it was, but it's not as high as it was either. The yen is the one we're looking at. It's under 159, so it's not coming right back to the panic number of 60, but it's higher than when it's lower than when we did the intervention. So far, our esteemed Secretary of the Treasury doesn't have to do any more, but I assume he's watching it. The pound 135. They're actually up more than the euro, so they're probably the strongest of the currencies in the last few weeks. Crypto down 566, 62.779. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. It rains every day. Did we shift? Did the earth shift here or something?
I don't really know what's going on, Chief, but I know that there's a lot of rain coming. Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:38 here in Chicago. We're looking at 73 degrees right now with a high of 79. Partly sunny and humid with a thunderstorm in parts of the area today. Tonight, mostly cloudy and humid. Heavy rain, of course, and a low of 72 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 83 degrees right now with a high of 101. Partly sunny with a thunderstorm is plus this afternoon. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 84 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Iman Kennedy from Montrose, 13 minutes. We're looking at 27 minutes. Iman Edens from Lake Cook. Eisenhower from Wolf is 20 minutes. We're looking at 16 minutes. Then Ryan from 95th. And Stevenson from 294 is 21 minutes. For the MLB, White Sox lose to Reds 9-8 yesterday. And Cubs lose to Nationals 7-0. So today we got Cardinals at Cubs at 1:20 p.m. White Sox at Tigers, 5:40 p.m. And D-backs at Braves, 6:15 p.m. For the NFL preseason, lastly, Broncos at Falcons, Bucks at Jets, and Dolphins at Commanders, all at 6 p.m. today. All I got for you, Chief. Back to you.
So Carl, we've had nothing but rain here, right? So I like to keep track just for my own, why I got interested in it, because I wrote all these books about Chicago and water management and all those kinds of things, and deep tunnel. And anyway, it's an interest for me. So the hydraulic surge, hydrology service, has all these buoys at all these areas. They can tell you how how high the river is, right? Or right. A creek or whatever.
Right.
Unbeknownst to you, now they've changed all that. I imagine somewhere they got something you can find it, but now the map, if you go to like the Des Plaines River at Riverside.
Yeah.
It used to be simple, like normal 5 feet, minor flood 7, major flood 10, record,
right,
you know,
right.
15 or something.
Yeah, those gauges have been there forever.
Yeah. See, now you're behind here a little bit. Now, if you go there, what do you get? Flowage per minute.
What?
And I'm like, what the hell is that?
And well, that's actually, that is another important.
I get that part, but it, for a dummy like me. So I go to five of them yesterday, and they go flowage, you know, X at whatever it is per minute of new record for this date. What does that even mean? I mean, obviously it means it's high. I get that part. But for this date, what's the record the time? I mean, there's no chart there that says, oh, by the way, normally it's so low at this date that even though it's a record for this date, it's not even flood level. There's no explanation for anything. It says the comment is record for this date, and I'm going, why can't you just tell me it's 12 feet when it's normally 2?
I mean, obviously somebody's interested in that not being evident here, right?
Yeah, but who are these people?
Chief, God, I don't know. There's so much. The level of insanity and corruption is just, it's off the rack. Okay, it just is.
I think, Carol, honestly, it's to the point where it is so prevalent. It's like politicians lying. It's so prevalent that people don't even, they think it's reached the normal stage. There's no place you can. It's like if there's 45 people going 100 miles an hour, they obviously think it's normal. It's not one person doing it thinking that he's you know, he needs a spanking or something. We're talking about, what are you talking about? Why are you stopping?
Why is that a problem?
Yeah, why is that a problem? I mean, I don't know what in this society what we're going to do if we ever reach. I think we're there. I don't know what's the what if you're just driving around with your nephews? You know, if you have a nephew who's 5 years old and he goes, "Hey, Uncle Tom, why do those four guys go through the red light?" What do you even say?
Yeah. I don't know. I just...
Anyway, I described earlier in the show, I don't know if you were listening, kind of the two investment... Oh, and there's all kinds of iterations of this. If you look at the market, I mean, anybody... And I as you know, I look at these numbers kind of like you do. I'm sort of horrified with where it looks like we're headed. But I'll tell you what, in my management for people... I'm letting the upside. I don't sell calls like I used to at all, because no matter what happens, we are on
track.
Well,
you're going to get run over and called out.
Yeah, you're going to get run over. I kind of fought the market for a while when I thought it was just going up too fast, and I didn't do as well for a while for my clients as I used to. Well, I've stopped doing that, and now we're doing, you know, way better, because I'm just, instead of being rational, I'm just kind of rolling with the flow, except I am keeping the put protection for everybody, which, by the way, some of the stocks I have, even though the rest of the market's doing great, are way down, so it's a good thing we have them. When I say I have them, people bring those stocks in. They weren't my choice. But, you know, this idea coming through COVID, I mean, talk about a lesson. We went through a depression. When we're done with it, the stocks are way higher than when we started. So it's not surprising to me. It's not surprising to the 2025 chief, it would be stunning to me of the 1985 chief that you could have a war that's not going so hot, and all of a sudden we're higher than we were when the war started, with oil prices where they are and the amount of money the government's pissed away. But I'll be briefer here. The one path is, no matter what, come deficit or hell or high water, the government is going to protect fixed prices of stocks and property to the extent that they're going to go down. Well, they're going to try.
They're going to try.
Okay, but okay, I understand. This is the part where I agree with you, so we don't have to argue about it. But the point is, they've gone further than either you or I thought possible.
Yes.
And the chance of them, let's say, changing their attitude before this election or the next election or the next election... That's so on one path, on one street, we'll call it the good street, this is going to keep going forever, and every time the stock goes down, you turn around and buy it. And you have people like at CNBC, like a Tom Lee, every time it's down, oh man, you know, you just don't get it, you got to start buying this stuff. Or you see stocks trading for, you know, 100 times earnings, and their view of the world is, I don't care what the world is, this stuff's all going to be up on that side. Now, on the other side is the stuff that you and I maybe foolishly look at. We look at some of the valuations. We look at a basketball team being bought for 20 times revenue. I mean, obviously, right. there's money out there. And we will sit there and say, the cliff is going to be there someplace. And now there seems to be even less regard for even watching for it. With Trump doing anything he wants to get back in. And part of that is keeping the market up. He said the other night, the market set a new record. That's all because of me. Okay, so those things, they have not collided. I sure as hell don't think they're going to collide today or next week. But by the same token, I'm in your camp is more than I ever have been. Boy, we got a problem here. And no, take it from here.
Okay. So my column, because of course I knew I was coming on this morning. So one of the things that has been thrown around both on my forum and in other places, and I've seen all over the places, is the disbelief between what's going on with regards to the war and the Strait of Hormuz, which is all factual and easily externally verified, okay, despite, oh, yeah, it's open. I do whatever. Okay, marine traffic is real-time AIS transponders because...
Hey, you're the guy, you just brought it up. I wanted to ask you this. The amount of ships that I knew you keep track of are way down, despite what people say. There has been the estimates of people getting workarounds through pipelines and other places to be growing. Can you put those two together? I mean,
yes, this is kind of where I'm going with
okay.
this. Okay. So marine traffic is essentially a site that just takes and aggregates together and puts on a map for you AIS transponder data, which is much like an aircraft transponder.
Aren't some of these guys running without a transponder, though?
Well, no. And here's, well, now, in the strait itself, which is a confined waterway, for security reasons, if you're under escort, then the answer can be yes. Okay, in other words, if the United States Navy is escorting you through this contested waterway, they may very well tell you to turn it off. All right. However, in open water, the international regulations require that it be on. And the reason is it's a collision reduction thing. Okay.
If it's foggy, you know the guy's out there instead of having a horn
I mean, the thing is, you are, and I know a little bit about this because I had a fairly large boat, and in order to be a reasonably responsible owner and operator of something like that, if you're not going to hire a licensed captain, you have to understand the rules. And one of them is that all of the means that you have of ascertaining position of other things and avoiding collision, all of the ones you have available to you, you must use. Now, that does not mean that if I've got a small boat and I don't have a radar set on it, I have to put one on it. Okay? It does not mean that. It means, however, that if I have a radar set, I got to use it. All right? I can't leave it off, and then if there's a collision, I'm going to get tagged if I've done that, if I've left it off. All right? I'm going to get tagged because I have deliberately reduced my situational awareness.
Just out of stupid curiosity, if you got a 40-foot boat and put a radar, is the radar pretty good?
No, they're not bad. It depends on how much money you spend on it.
How far can you detect somebody before you get the curvature?
Oh, well, that depends on how high your antenna is, okay? I mean, that's
I knew that. I was saying normally it would...
Normally you're talking about 10 or 15 miles.
So if it's 15 feet in the air, it's 10 or 15 miles.
Yeah, if it's like on above the bridge of a sport fish, which is where mine was, okay, I mean, the actual antenna is probably 15, maybe 20 feet off the water. And, now, of course, that depends on what is out there.
if what's out there is a 100-foot-high commercial ship, then I have more space because I can see it further because that vessel is further off the water.
Okay.
Okay, so, I mean, the curvature of the Earth is... Now, the larger ships, because their antennas are so much higher, they pay for much better units that have much more power. But for a recreational vessel, the only reason you do that is to be able to resolve things like birds, because that gives you some information that's very usable in terms of, like, if there's birds feeding, there's probably fish. Okay.
All right.
Which by the way, is what I had the boat for. Okay. But even the cheapest radar set can see plenty far enough to where the curvature of the horizon is the limiting factor with any kind of reasonable size vessel.
All right, so you can, so in other words, you can pretty much tell how many ships are going through here with a couple of transponders.
Oh, absolutely, right. And yeah, without any doubt at all. And the thing is, though, is these transponders, the way that the rules are set up, once you get to about 65 feet in anything commercial, you have to have one on it. So, and that's just required by international regulations. If you sail in international waters, you have to have it. So, and the coal regs are that if you have a navigational aid and you have it available to you, you have to use it. Now, it God help you if you don't and there's an incident. So, they do. But the thing is would you turn them off in the strait? Yeah. And then as soon as you come through the strait on the other side, you turn it back on. Okay. So the traffic would be there, it would be visible where it's going. And what you see when you look up in the Gulf is a whole crap ton of these vessels sitting there. They're not moving. Now, I assure you that given the cost of just the food for the dudes on board, plus the power for the generator, and you know, because you got to have electricity, right, for HVAC and pumps and everything else, lights, that is not a cheap undertaking. You are not just going to sit there on a commercial vessel like that unless you have to. If you're not moving, you're not making any money.
But people have been, I won't say brainwashed, even though I just did, into thinking everything that goes through there is oil. But really, the stuff for fertilizer, the container ships.
Oh, God, it's all sorts of things. Yeah.
Even if somebody sneaks a tanker through, well... I'm going to say from what I've read, and this is why I'm asking you to clean this up for me. When I read the number before any of this started was about 100 ships a day, and they're down to like 20 or 25. Am I anywhere near close?
Yeah, it's there's a few getting through, but not many. But now here's the thing. So like if you go take a look at the other strait. To the west southwest, which is the one that borders Yemen, and then that inland sea also has an outlet at the Suez going north, okay, into the Med. So if you're talking about that, that's the Balabab. I don't know how to pronounce it. Anyway, it's the other one that's over there that the Houthis have been causing a little trouble with. There is very clearly a lot of traffic going through there. All right.
And that's partially because Saudi has the one pipeline that they're jamming as much as they can. It gets it from one side to the other. So
yeah,
they've been able to off some of it.
Well, not only that, if you're going to Europe with it, you probably want to go up through that way through the Suez anyway, right? Because it's...
That's why they had the pipeline in the first place.
I'm just saying, why would you go around?
What would you guess,
around?
if you had a stab at it, would you say that the pipeline was 70% of capacity before, and now it's 95. That's sort of what I would
do. I'm sure that they're using every alternative path available to them at its fullest capacity. Okay, but here's the thing: everything's priced at the margin. As you know, because you trade, and you know anybody that does, every barrel of oil you want to burn today, you pay the same. You pay the same price as the last one.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
All right. I mean, that's just the way it works. You go to the gas station.
A little LIFO.
Well, but you go to the gas station. That guy got a new tanker in. He may have been a quarter full when that tanker dropped, but you're going to pay the tanker's price for all the gas you put in your car.
Yeah, and the gas station guy gets it. He gets it one way the right way and one way the other way.
And the wrong way goes up his back door.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just the way it works. All right. So now we take these things and we say, okay, we've got a supply dislocation and it's real. And there isn't any, you cannot run some conspiracy theory and say that isn't happening, because it very clearly is. You can see it. Everybody can see it. And not only that, you have the impressed costs of all of these non-moving vessels, and there's a crap ton of them, all right? And those costs are ending up on their owners and you know, the rest of the supply chain generally, right? Because that expense has no revenue side. All right, so all of that's real in the economy on a global basis. Now you contrast this and you say, how is it that oil is reasonably well behaved? How is it it's not $400 a barrel, right? Secondly, why isn't gas $10 a gallon? And there is no, you can't say the oil's not flowing. The oil very clearly is not flowing, right? You can't say, well, you know, that's a conspiracy theory. No, it's a fact. It's not flowing. All right. So what the F is going on here? Well, you got 2.5 explanations for this. The half is we had, and we always normally have, a decent amount of product in storage that is, it's temporarily there, it rolls through just like the gas in the tank at your gas station.
President criticized Biden for getting it out of the national storage. He's down to like zero in the storage, isn't he?
Well, no, he's not. But that's the thing.
He's getting there.
Yeah, but Chief, everyone said when this thing started that within a month that you were going to be effectively at tank bottom, that you weren't going to be able to pull it out of there.
And we're not.
And we're not. Okay. So what this tells me is two things. One is that, okay, the obvious first thing you do, if I've got a tank full of diesel sitting there and I've got trouble getting supply for more crude to make more diesel, I'm going to sell what I have in the tank. All right? And as long as I've still got some, you don't see a crisis because I've still got some. Okay, that's the half answer. Eventually, obviously, if I'm not putting more in the tank, I'm going to run out. Right? That's clearly going to happen. The somewhat speculative second-level answer is demand destruction. And I have seen this anecdotally around here this summer. The traffic levels are lower. The number of people in bars and restaurants and stuff are down substantially from what I normally see in this area. But this is local. And I am always very careful about trying to generalize what I see in a given place across the entire country, because boy, that could be a mistake.
Let me help you with the economics of that, just a hair.
Well, so hang on. So let me go a little further. All right, now last month I chased Train. All right, I went after Big Boy, got some very nice video. So I saw this in that swath of the country, which was a fairly decent sized swath that I covered while I was doing this, and I saw the same sort of thing. But then we got the CPI report. And in the CPI report last month, there was a 4% decrease in hotels on the month, not annualized. That's a big drop.
Well, it was down a little bit again this month.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The report that just came out this week, a couple days ago, all right, 4% month over month decrease in lodging away from home, not including dorms at colleges and stuff like that, because the detail level table breaks it down a little bit better, all right? And that is essentially leisure and business level hotel rentals. That's the essence of what that is.
Well, yeah.
And that price index was down 4% month over month. Now, July...
That's if you can believe them, but yeah.
Well, yeah. Okay. But we're talking about the summer travel season and leisure recreation season, right? Normally, you would think demand would be high. Supply is relatively fixed. July would be a month you'd expect the prices would be firm, not really soft. 4% is a big move on a monthly basis.
Well, we don't have much time here, but this is actually an interesting economic, if you give a crap about supply and demand curves because they are
curves. Well, hold on. Let me add the last piece to
this. Go
ahead. Okay. Because we also just got the last jobs report, right? You know, like a week ago, right? And, you know, we talked about it on the air when it came out. Okay. Here's the one that this is not. So I think there's a demand destruction thing going on. That's somewhat speculative. I can't prove it. But here's the one that's not speculative at all. If you take the jobs report from when Trump came into office, you take the total delta of job additions. We're not population adjusting here. These are just raw numbers. And then you subtract out health care and social services. The economy's lost 500,000 jobs. Now, that is in an environment where we have data center construction going on, all this AI employment, all this blah, 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 all these rah, 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 everything's wonderful. That is, the facts are that the only reason we have a positive number across Trump's second term thus far is two fields that are both parasitic. They produce nothing. They are necessary. Healthcare is that keeps a guy who's working today able to work tomorrow. Okay, fine. But by itself, it produces nothing in terms of added. Now it shows up in GDP, but it is not a car. It is not a building. It is not a computer. It is not any of these things. And yet, if you take that back out, you have a net 500,000 loss since Trump took office. And this is in a supposedly great renaissance of reshoring, American productivity, all the tripe that we all get fed every day.
Not to mention, if you ever listen to him.
Well, I'm just saying, the data says he's full of crap. Okay.
Well, it's
worse than that. The current run rate for interest on the federal deficit is approximately $1.3 trillion. And it is rising exponentially. That rate cycle turned in 2019. I have been talking about this a while.
These guys got it at interest on federal debt, and debt is $1.1 trillion.
It's the annualized number, the run rate at this point is 1.3.
That's because you're taking the newer rates in. We got to dash here. Give me just 1 minute to give a 4-hour lecture on demand curves. Usually stuff is either inelastic or elastic, and oil is always considered very inelastic.
Right.
Because, you know, all of a sudden the gas price go up tomorrow and you got to go to the doctor, you're going to go to the doctor, right? But now it's been 5 or 6 months, which, you know, it's supposed to be a few days, but it's been 5 or 6 months. But when you say demand destruction, that's a new word for people who don't know how to, not you, Carl, people who don't know how to look at a demand curve. Because gas at $3.50 a gallon versus gas at $4 a gallon, and tomorrow you're going to say that's inelastic. It means people are going to buy maybe the same amount. But if now it's 4 months, if it's $4 6 months from now, some adjustments from some people have been made to where maybe they carpool the kids to work or they do something. Now, I'm not saying you don't use any gas. I mean, I'm not going to say that. But people find a way, you know, even if a guy like me, you know, if I live somewhere where I was married in the wife had some little puddle jumper, which would never be Audrey because she likes something with power. I mean, I might if I'm going up to, you know, to get a six pack because Carl's coming over, I'll probably plop my ass in the little one because it loses more gas, even though I hate it, instead of my truck. Okay, you see those kinds of adjustments that can't really happen on day one. So when they call it demand destruction, it's really the demand curve getting a little less. A little more elastic over time.
It has some elasticity to it.
Sure. Over time. So I think what I've been reading, Carl, and I'll run this by you, two questions we got to add. I hear China's, I won't use the term demand, because demand hasn't changed, but because the price is higher, the quantity demanded has changed. Those are two specific economic terms, and they're not the same.
Right.
Demand is not quantity demanded. So they have essentially adjusted downward. And I would bet Japan has as well, because they buy pretty much everything from overseas. So there's been some, I won't say demand destruction, because if you looked at the graph, it was always there. People are buying somewhat less because the prices are higher. I think that's and so even if so, if they get 80% of the stuff out of the Strait, and it's 20% of all the world's oil, at this price, it quote might be enough.
By the way, retail sales was out while we were on the air. Huge miss, down 0.6.
That's good, because that's going to lower interest rates.
Yeah.
God, do I hate these good news. All right, so we got the 400. Last question. You got to be right on this one. We're having this collision. We just figured out on the date. $400 billion last month is the Treasury's thing. I'm sure you saw that.
Yep.
How many more of those can we do before the big, beautiful barf bill? Taxes have to go up. Something has to go up. Something has to happen.
And taxes have to go up, and the medical monster has to have its nuts cut off. And one way or another, it's going to have to happen, because if it doesn't, you're going to see a spike in the Treasury market that they cannot control.
Well, we'll talk about it on Tuesday, but have a nice weekend. Here, all we're going to do is rain all weekend. We've got to be like 8 inches higher than normal here.
What? We had a nice break in it here yesterday, and I got to see a nice Smokies game, and we won. So, you know, the Cubs affiliate, son of a bitch.
Is there anybody there that bears watching?
Yeah, not really so much. I mean, you know.
There's not one guy that stands out?
Well, when it was over in Kodak, we had Moises, who ended up getting called up.
There you go.
But I didn't see anything.
He just got traded.
Yeah, well.
I kind of liked him.
I'll tell you what, at the AA level, that guy, when he picked up a stick, he was a menace.
Oh, yeah. S&P futures up 6, NASDAQ futures up 82. Nice job, Ricky. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.